You're listening to the Save the Marriage Podcast. Your marriage can be saved and strengthened if you have the right information. Join Dr. Lee Baucom as he explores ways for you to improve your relationship and your life, starting right now.
Hey, this is Lee Baucom, and I do want to welcome you to the Save the Marriage Podcast. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. And thank you for being willing to work on saving your marriage. Now, I've got a couple of emails for this last week that basically said, how do I know whether I can save my marriage or not? How do I know whether I should put forth the effort or not? And I want you to notice something about that question. That question is bound into fear. It's based on the idea that I don't want to move forward if I don't know what's going to happen. I know that's a place of struggle for lots of people, so I want to just talk briefly about some things you can think about how to judge where you are in the relationship. So I usually use two different pieces of information that are very important. It's the severity and the longevity of the situation. So let's talk about each of those so you can kind of assess your relationship in your own mind about where that is. First, let's talk about severity. Severity is talking about the acuteness of the crisis. How acute, how bad it is. In other words, has there been one thing that suddenly erupted, or is it something that's kind of over a longer period of time? For instance, if there has been a fight, you know, you've gotten into a struggle, and it's a fight, and it's an unusual fight, a big argument that you just can't come to terms with, and you just go, you know what, this is so bad, we're going to divorce. But it's the first time it's happened. That's far less severe than perhaps somebody who has had infidelity in the relationship or has compounding effects of infidelity. Perhaps there's even been multiple affairs, or there's also addiction or mental illness or lots of other complicating factors. So in that case, you begin to look at how severe, how many different pieces of the puzzle are there and how bad the situation is. What we know is the more severe the crisis is, the more difficult it is to deal with, the more it complicates things. It just kind of stands to reason. It's kind of like a physical illness. The more severe the illness, the harder it is to get back from that illness. Think of it as similarly to like an infection. If you have a small infection, your body is going to naturally fight it off. But if your body is just overwhelmed with infection, it makes it very hard for the body to fight back and can sometimes put it under, even if it's just a sudden spike in that infection. Because that also compares to the longevity of the crisis. Sometimes a crisis has a longer life. Sometimes I hear of people who basically have struggled for years and years and years, as opposed to those who are talking about just a little bit of time, a couple of weeks, even a couple of months. It may not surprise you, and it certainly doesn't surprise me anymore, that there are times when people will come into my office and they will basically say, you know what, we got to call it quits. This has just been so hard. It's so tough. I just don't know what else to do. And I'll go, wow, you know, how long has this crisis been going on? And they'll say 3 weeks. Well, 3 weeks is not the longevity I'm talking about. Sometimes they don't even have an acute situation. It's not a severity situation. And it's not even a chronic situation, the longevity. And those are the two different pieces that I look for about how hard is this going to be to get back. But you'll notice that there's something important about that. There's a self-perception piece to it. Sometimes people who have been in a crisis for 3 weeks think that they have done everything and said everything and tried everything. And then there are those who have been struggling for 10 years who still say, we're going to get through this. So these two scales only give a basis of a thought process. How severe, which is how acute the situation is, and how long, the longevity of the crisis, or how chronic, which is pretty much how we assess physical illness or physical problems. How acute and how chronic are they? And that gives you some places to begin to think about where your relationship is and how hard it might be to solve that, to cure the relationship. But I want you to take away that one very crucial piece. There is a huge subjectivity to that process. What I mean by that is how we think of it subjectively is as important as the objective reality. when somebody thinks that their crisis is absolutely acute, it becomes an absolutely acute crisis. When somebody feels like they have been working on it for a long time, there's a subjective measurement of that time. So I use those two frameworks, both in what somebody tells me and how that feels to you. And that's very important because your spouse may be at that point of having a very different subjective view than you have. You may be going, this isn't so bad, or you may be saying, this hasn't been going on so long, and your spouse is absolutely overwhelmed, and your spouse sees it as having lasted for an entire lifetime, even if it's short term. The problem with this is it's very difficult to deal with subjective. I've watched it a number of times. I remember when a couple was in my office and this was the exact scenario. One was exasperated. The man was completely exasperated and was ready to give up. And the woman just felt like they had just begun to maybe even start addressing the situation. And no matter what she said, all he did was become more entrenched in the idea that this was irretrievable because of how severe it was, how acute, and how long it had lasted, how bad, how chronic it had become. When I heard the time frame and I heard the acuteness, it lay somewhere in between their two frameworks. So use those as scales, understanding that while there may be some objectivity to it, there is also a great deal of subjectivity. And also where one marks the beginning point of the crisis, another might mark it at a very different place in your relationship, and that changes how that is. So what does that mean about whether you can save your marriage or not? You know, the questions and emails were, when is it a no-go? When is it no way that we're going to save this relationship? So I'll give you my answer about what I think is the serious point of delineation. I mark out when there has been abuse. When there's been physical abuse, I automatically say this is not the time to work on the relationship. This is a time to get yourself safe. That does not mean you can never work on your relationship, but it means it's not the time right now when there has been physical abuse, because the abuser needs to find the reasons why they're abusive and find ways of dealing with that before anything ever happens. The truth of the matter is, many times, somebody who has abused one time will continue to abuse and to escalate. It becomes unsafe. That's not all the time, but enough that it's no longer safe when there's physical abuse. And what I mean by physical abuse is when somebody has been pushed, shoved, hit, choked, anything that is really physically against you, harm to your body. And I'm not talking about, you know, if somebody in a moment grabs an arm and maybe grabs a little harder than they intended to. I mean, when it's a bruising hit or a grab and a shake or a choking move, any choking hold or any hit, all bets are off. That at that point, I draw the line. I also say that emotional abuse falls in this category, but that's a lot trickier. That's a lot trickier for someone from the outside to say, oh, there's the line. Because you're going to have to decide, if you feel like you're in the midst of an emotional abusive situation, do you qualify it as emotionally abusive? Because emotionally abusive is a little slippery. You know, when somebody calls you a name, is that emotional abuse? Some would say yes, some would say no. If you're constantly yelled at, is that emotional abuse? So let me tell you the measurement I use. When the emotional abuse is behavior that is meant to control you, and behavior that is meant to cut you off, and behavior that is meant to intimidate you, intimidation and control being the two central pieces to abuse, that really is the heart of any abuse, physical or emotional. It's when it's meant to intimidate and control you. And when that happens, it crosses a line and becomes abusive. And that's when I say, you know what, it's not time to work on the relationship. It's time to move away from the relationship and find some safety. Personal safety trumps the marriage. So then other people say, well, what about affairs? Well, I've seen too many people recover from affairs. What about dishonesty? I've seen too many couples recover from dishonesty. So the place that I draw the line for myself is the place of abuse. At that point, no, you should not be working on it. The others become a personal choice. I think that you can point to any major religion that has an issue with divorce and notice that they all give an out on infidelity. That's also a legal definition in most states. So at that point, it's a choice. Does the person who has suffered the infidelity decide to go through the process and move beyond the hurt of that to stay in the relationship? That's different than the abuse. Abuse is a no-go. Which brings up the question of why do we get ourselves in these situations? And I would say that the pieces that we need to focus on as we're working to save the marriage are about our boundaries and our standards. Now, let's talk about, just for a moment, the difference between boundaries and standards, because they become very important in dealing with a crisis, whether it's a crisis that's acute or a crisis that has longevity and is chronic. It doesn't matter. It's about those boundaries and standards. A boundary is what you will not let someone do to you. A standard is what you expect yourself to live into. A boundary is a marker, a delimitation of where you say, this is where I begin and end, where I take control over my area. A standard, though, is when you say, this is how I will be in the world, how I present myself into the world. And it's a very important distinction between those two. We often cross them up in society. In fact, one of the biggest things I see in people struggling to get to where they want to in life is the fact that they don't know how to defend their boundaries, and they try to put their standards on other people. So let's just kind of imagine that a boundary is kind of like a fence in your backyard. It's not like the moat and something protecting a castle. It's not a fortress. It's a marker around your space. If you make it a fortress, it becomes no longer a boundary, but a hindrance to relationships. Some people say, oh, I've set a boundary, and really they've created a fortress that does not allow anybody into their space. Before we moved, we lived with neighbors that tended to have a difficult time recognizing boundaries. We had a fence in our backyard. They would come around our house, down our driveway, and through the fence and through the gate into our backyard with their dog. And when we finally said, hey, you know what? It really scares our kids when you're out back. Can you please not do that? Their response was, well, that's where their dog wandered. You see, they just wandered through. It's not that they didn't see the fence. They just didn't care about the fence, and that's true in our life. And so then we have to defend, how are we going to do more of that? So then we had to close off our gate and say, you know, that gate is closed. You can't go in there. In other words, we're marking our property, and it's just like our boundaries. Sometimes people cross our boundaries, and we have to remind them of that space. So it's a fence that tells people how to treat us. Think about the people you know that you know exactly how they are going to demand to be treated. They don't have to tell you not to raise their voice at them. They don't have to tell you not to use a bad word towards them. They don't have to tell you that you can't call them bad things. You just know that you have to be respectful, that you need to show up on time, that you need to treat them in certain ways. They have created the boundaries that don't even have to be pointed out. It's like you put out the fence and it's just there. But then there are people that are constantly upset that people yell at them, call them names, do all kinds of mistreatment, and don't see the fact that it is their responsibility to monitor their boundary. Your boundary is your own. And what most people find is, as they begin to get better at setting boundaries, they find more and more boundaries that they need to watch. I had a client that came in because she really was in what I would have considered to be a somewhat abusive relationship, and she couldn't decide what to do about it. And so I said, you know, what is your boundary here? And she said, I don't want him to grab me anymore. And I said, okay, so let's set that as a boundary. That's a clear boundary. For me, a absolute boundary is no physical contact in aggressive ways. You know, if someone comes at you aggressively, for me, that's a boundary violation for all of us. So you got to decide that for yourself. So that was a very basic one. And so she went home and she used some strategies to set that boundary. She says, you cannot grab me. If you keep doing that, I will leave. You know, there are several options she had in setting that boundary. But remember, a boundary has to have a consequence Otherwise, it's not a boundary. If I say, you know, don't do this, but there's no reason why not to do this, it's not really setting a boundary. And so she set the boundary and said, you cannot touch me. If you do, I will leave the house. If you touch me again, I will call the police. That's a clear boundary. So he stopped. He realized that was not a way he could treat her anymore because it no longer intimidated her. She called him on it. So then she realized that the next boundary she had was that she did not want to be yelled at. Now, when I'm working with couples, I encourage them to use words not yelled at, but raising your voice. The reason is if you say yell, you get into a debate about whether the person was yelling or not. Raising your voice is a much more objective way of saying it. And the volume goes up, you're raising your voice. What's the definition of yelling? Much more slippery. So she decided that she was going to set the boundary of him not raising his voice. Now she used the three-step process. And if you want the three-step process in detail, you can find that in the main module of the Save the Marriage system that you can get at SaveTheMarriage.com. If you don't have it, if you do have it, make sure you attend to that because that three-step process is powerful if you use it. And so what she said is when he raises voice, she just kind of question him about that. Did you realize that you're raising your voice? Okay, because at that point, you're just pointing it out to the person. At that point, the person may say, oh, I'm so sorry. Or the person may say, yes, and I meant to. At which point, you make a request that they not do that. Please do not raise your voice at me. Again, at that point, they have a choice of de-escalating, of saying, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. Or they can continue. In this case, the first time, he said, I meant to raise my voice, and I will raise my voice. To which she said, if you keep raising your voice at me, for first she said, you may not raise your voice at me, and then she followed up with, if you continue, I will leave the house. Consequence. So you're informing, you're asking, you're telling, and then there's a consequence. That's the three stages. And so when she got to the consequence, he knew that and he backed off because he'd seen her respond to that before. So that worked. He stopped raising his voice. And then we talked again and she said, you know what? I don't want him to call me names. So she went through the same process again, calling him on the calling the names. And then he got creative, as most people do when they're testing your boundaries. He started using the initials of what he had been calling her before. So she had to call him on that. And what you notice with that pattern is as we begin to set our patterns, we become more and more, set our boundaries. We become more and more clear about what our boundaries are and what is not acceptable. And we get better and better at setting the boundaries when we start. One of the roots of an angry response is because we feel like we have to lash out because we don't know how to set our boundaries. If you know how to set your boundaries, you really don't have to lose your temper because you know that there's a consequence at the end and you can be calm about it. Remember, you can't set your own boundaries by crossing somebody else's boundaries. So you treat them with respect while you're setting your boundary. So that's the setting the boundary to let people know how to treat you. That in itself can transform your marriage, your parenting style, your relationships at work, your relationship with your friend. And if you've ever found yourself saying, I can't believe that person would treat me that way, and you're still in a relationship with them without setting a boundary, that's not their bad, that's your bad. Your boundaries are for you to protect. Not to expect that somebody else is going to know them until you teach it to them, until you teach them how you want to be treated, which is the heart of a boundary, which is different than a standard. A standard is what you expect of yourself, how you will live into the world, how you will treat other people. So you may say to yourself, you know what, I'm going to treat other people with lovingness and kindness and honesty. Those are standards. And here's the tricky part. You can't put your standards on somebody else. And I don't mean that philosophically. I mean that practically. I hear lots of people, when I bring that up, they're upset because they feel like I'm telling them that they cannot tell their children to be honest. It's not a philosophy piece. You may be able to say to your child, you really ought to be honest with everybody in the world, but let's be practical. You can't make them. You can't make somebody be honest. You can't make someone live into some high standard in their life unless they take that on themselves. You can say to your child, if you're dishonest with me, you will be grounded. But that doesn't mean that they won't leave your house and be dishonest with everybody around them or even with you. So you can't control their behavior. You only have a consequence for when they break the boundary. See, you cross over from what is your standard to what becomes a boundary for you. You're going to say, I am going to be honest with everybody in the world. Whether that's possible or not, that's a different philosophical debate. But when your child is there, you can't make them be honest. You can only have consequences when they're dishonest with you. That's the difference between the boundary and the standard. And one of the places we fall into the trap is we constantly try to put our standards on other people. It doesn't work with children, and it doesn't work with your spouse. It only creates more conflict because your standard is your own and your boundaries are your own. Notice where this moves us. It moves us to a place of emotionality versus rationality. Are we responding out of our emotions, which is what happens when we don't know what our standards are and we don't set our boundaries with other people? Or are we working from a rationality point, a point of strength, where we know what our boundaries are, where we'll protect ourselves, and we know what we expect of ourselves, what we'll live into the world? At that point, we've crossed into a very interesting place. Because it takes us to a place that's about responsibility in your life, being responsible for where your life is. Now, hear me well in this. Responsibility is not the same as blame. We often confuse those words in our culture. Blame comes from a place of looking to point to somebody else for what has happened. Responsibility is asking, what can I do in this situation? Blame is about, what do I get? How can I get back at somebody? Responsibility is, what can I do? How can I move forward from where I am? Blame has at its root the question, why me? Which really is seeing that you don't have responsibility. You're looking for that outside source going, it's their fault. It's my spouse's fault. It's my kid's fault. It's my job's fault. It's stress's fault. It's lots of different things' fault. This is not about blame and fault. It's about saying, what can I do from where I am now, given what's here, what the now is? What can I do? And that's a much more powerful place to be. I use the example often about if you're standing in the middle of a burning house, you can look around and you can ask, who did this? How did this catch on fire? Or you can say, what do I need to do to get myself and others out of this building safely? One is about blame, which will only leave you in a burning down building. The other is about responsibility of what can you do given what's going on now. So we want to be very clear that when we're working on our relationships, that we're not going, who's at fault here? That is a tactic that therapy often falls into. A couple comes in, they argue their case, they're waiting for the therapist to say, who's at fault? Which is very different than saying, how do we get to where we want to get to? How do we have a thriving relationship, a loving relationship, one that we can treasure? It starts with saying, what can I do to get to that place? What can I do to move this along to a new place? So I want you to ask yourself some questions as you're going through about, are you at that place of taking responsibility? You can ask yourself, am I on task? In other words, am I moving this forward towards what I want to have happen? Am I on task? Because if you're not on task, you have not taken responsibility for where you are, and you may easily slip into, this isn't my problem, somebody else needs to fix it. If you're on task, you're saying, what can I do with where I am? How can I get to a different place? So then you might want to ask yourself, am I moving forward, or am I trying to pull the other to me? That's the place of blame. If you say, I don't need to move, the other person needs to come to me, you've established blame subtly, but you've established blame. you'll notice that many times I am suspicious of when a spouse comes to me and says, how can I get my spouse to fill in the blank? When you say, how can I get my spouse to do something, you are doing a couple of things at the same time. One is, you're going to be manipulating them, trying to control them, trying to get them to do something. That's manipulation control. Two is, it assumes that you don't need to take action that they do. You don't need to move that they do. You're not at the wrong place. They are. Which may be true, but is not helpful. This is not about going, how did we get here? It's about how do we get to where we want to get to, which requires a large piece of being willing to step away from the how did we get here question. The last one of the question ask yourself is, am I being clear and consistent? When you look at the world of marketing or of politicians, one of the important questions is to say, am I on message? Do I keep portraying where I want to get to and what I want to represent? Or do you keep moving around the map? One of the hallmarks of people who have a difficult time with their boundaries are those who are not clear with what they want to be treated like, of how they wanted to be treated, how they want somebody to interact with them. When they can't be clear about that, they are not going to monitor their boundaries. So when we're lacking clarity, it's a good sign that we have not really decided where we want to go to. We're still at a stuck place. So now, as you think about your relationship and what you should do now, you ask the question, how severe, how acute is this? What's the longevity? How chronic is this? That gives you some idea of how much effort it might take. Not whether it can be done or not, but how much effort it might take. Then if you address for yourself, what are your boundaries? And what do you expect of yourself? You're transforming your life. You'll become a person who teaches people how to treat you and who steps into the world in a different way because you step into your standards. And we can always raise our standards. We can always say, I expect more of myself. And when you do that, you transform your life, both by setting a standard, a boundary of how people can treat you and a standard of how you're going to be in the world. Which takes us to this place of responsibility, of saying, what can I do? I'm not going to go looking for blame. I would suggest that that's a crucial switch in a standard. If you haven't made that yet, I invite you to make that leap from who's at fault to what can I do? When you do that, you will have upped your standard. What can I do from here is about responsibility. How did we get here? Why are we here? Notice the difference. When we're asking the why questions, why did this happen? When you ask that, how did we get here? Why did we get here? That usually is an indicator that you're stuck in blame. Versus when you ask the question, what? What can I do here? What is possible for us to move forward? What will get us to a different place? How can I do that? Sometimes the how is on the fence, but the what is usually an indicator that you are about responsibility. Why is about blame? And then you can ask your question, am I on task? Am I moving towards, or am I trying to pull someone toward me? And finally, am I being clear and concise? That begins to allow you to think through, where are you in this relationship? So I invite you to think through those as you continue to work to save your marriage and how you might assess some of the places in that relationship. Well, now it's your turn. This is when I ask you to give back a little bit and give me some feedback. And I want to do that a couple of ways. One is I want to know what you think about this material, what you think about what I just said. You can find the comment section just below. If you're on my blog and you're listening from the blog, you can just leave a comment there. I do read the comments and I do respond to them. So that's a good way of kind of responding and thinking through and processing the material for yourself.
If you are listening to this somewhere else, through iTunes or somewhere else, you can find the blog by going to SaveTheMarriageBlog.com. That's just SaveTheMarriageBlog.com. That'll get you right on there. You can leave comments directly there. You can also give me some feedback at podcast@SaveTheMarriage.com. That's the email for the podcast, podcast@SaveTheMarriage.com. If you'll let me know some other topics you might want to hear, that's not a place to be writing in about all your situation and trying to get feedback. We have other mechanisms for that. This is really about what would you like to hear about on the podcast. You can also leave a voicemail by calling 4-HELP-4-4-1-3-2. That's 4-HELP-4-4-1-3-2. Or the straight number is 443-574-4132. That's 443-574-4132. If you're out of the United States, of course, the beginning code is 1. And you can find us there. So those are some ways of finding me. If you're interested in that Kindle book, again, it's SaveTheMarriage.com/Kindle. That'll get you right there. And I want you to ask you to do something else. Can you share the word about this podcast? Now, this is information that is good for any marriage, and one of my difficulties is making sure that as many people hear this message as possible. So share this on Facebook if you don't mind. Share it and go to the iTunes podcast and rate it for me. There are lots of ways you can help, and that's a way for you to help me pass the word along. I'm here to provide as much information as I can, but I need your help. I'm asking for you to help me share this and get more people listening, so that more people can be affected by this, more people can improve their relationship, and we can make a shift in what happens to marriages in the world, not just right around you, not just your marriage, not just people in your state or your country, but in the whole world, just by getting the word out. So share with other people and say, you know what, this is about Save the Marriage, but it's really about marriage. I would appreciate it if you can help me spread the word as many ways as possible. Thank you. This is Lee Balcom, and I wish you the best as you continue to work to save and improve your marriage.
You've been listening to Save the Marriage podcast. For more information and help, please visit us at SaveTheMarriage.com.